welcome to Science Chat. This is Science Chat Rebooted. The reboot, it's not a massive reboot, but basically, still want to talk about science and science communication, those kind of topics. I think we're going to try and do it in a little bit more lighthearted. And for that reason, I'm actually joined today by a very good friend of mine, Rhonda Rana, who's a comedian, originally from Canada, spent some time in Ireland, and overall, all-around nice person. Hi, Rhonda, how are you?
Hi, Sean. I'm good. I'm chilling out here in sunny, cloudy, cold Toronto. Okay. How are you this evening?
Yeah,
it's evening.
It's evening here. Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, I have a couple of questions I want to ask you, Rhonda, because I was reading about this thing called the trolley problem, and I wrote a little blog about it, because again, my blog had been out of print for a couple of years, so I blogged a bit about it, and I got a few comments back, including a comment from you. So for people who might be listening to the podcast who are not aware of what the trolley problem is, I'm going to pose the trolley problem to you in the classic version, okay? So the classic version is a trolley, which for people who wouldn't know what a trolley is, we're talking about a kind of a tram in, what, early 20th century America, that kind of thing, is coming down the tracks, and it is heading towards five people who are working on the line, who are not going to hear it coming, they're not going to be aware of it, and if it continues on the line that it's on, it will kill those five people. And you're standing at a switch, and you have the possibility to throw that switch, and if you throw that switch, you will divert it to a line on which there's only one person working, obviously killing the one person. So the question is, what do you do?
What do I do? Well, that's a good question. I remember I had replied to you on your Twitter saying that I do love this problem. It's a thought experiment, but I also I misquoted the philosopher who's famous for tackling it. I said Nietzsche when it was Kant, but oh well, I'm not a philosopher anyways. What I would do, I wouldn't want to kill all the five people, but then the one person. I don't know. It would really depend on who they were.
But you're standing there. You don't know anything about them. You don't know who they are. You have to make a decision. Of course, it's one decision is you do nothing. So mm-hmm. It's not a case that your indecision is in any way beneficial. If you're indecisive, five people die.
Right.
So okay. That's the way to look at it. So if you can't make a decision, then the five people will die. Or if you don't feel happy in making a decision, the five people will die. So
right.
under those circumstances, you're still not willing to throw the switch, no?
Well, you know what? I'll have to throw the switch because if I don't do anything, then five people die. And then, if I don't do anything, then I can always, I can always claim that, like, oh, no, I didn't know what to do. I panicked in the situation. I, too, am a victim of this horrible – we need to sue the trolley people. This is what – you know what? This is the problem here. I'm just a citizen. I just happened to stumble in on a philosophical moral dilemma, you know. I was on my way to work, you know. Who's running this trolley anyways? Yeah. So,
and of all the people
then,
that
I've in that case, I won't do anything. I won't touch the lever. I'll let it kill the five people because then they'll all get their lawyers. You have the class action lawsuit. We're talking lots of money. We're talking about changing the law for a change. This will make the headlines. Five people dying because some greedy trolley car conglomerate, you know, doesn't care about all lives matter, you know. Okay, so that's my answer. I'll be a hero. Instead of a coward, I'll be known as a hero.
You're the first person I've spoken to about this who has actually suggested suing.
Yeah.
I think that's the big thing I've been missing up to now, suing. But of course, you don't just leave it up to the five people to sue the trolley company. I mean, you've seen it. You've witnessed it.
I'll sue too.
You know, that horrible decision. Yeah.
I'm just an idiot, you know. I go on a stage and tell a bunch of jokes. People don't even laugh. I'm deluded. I clearly have mental problems, you know. So, you know, they left this lunatic in charge, you know.
Well, they didn't leave in charge. You see, if I think if your defense is going to be that you're an idiot with mental problems, then I think you have no chance of winning any money. Because if the lawyer is anyway good, if that's where you're coming from, I don't even have a chance. But it is.
Well, hold on. I don't work for the trolley, though. They kind of... You know, put me in charge. I'm a victim too.
Right. Okay. Well.
Do I work for the trolley people? Sorry, you didn't make that part clear. You're just there.
The words "innocent bystander," I think, would adequately describe what you're supposed to be. But it's interesting.
I'm going to sue them for my lost innocence. Ha.
So joking apart.
Okay.
you would never throw the switch, yeah?
God, I don't know what I'd do. Okay. I don't know what I'd do.
Yeah, no, that's what I expected.
I'd probably scream, "Help, everyone, get out of the tracks. Look what's happening."
But, yeah, I think most people would kind of be in a similar situation to you. I know in a lot of places where they talk about this kind of thought experiment, and it is a thought experiment. It's, and when it's brought up in philosophy studies and things like that, that's kind of the attitude of most people. And you do get some people who will say, well, I'm kind of pragmatic, it's one or five, I'll go for the one and save the five, and it's nothing to do with being a hero, that's just what I'll do. Which is what then when or why you come in with the second alternative, which is the fat man story, okay? Now, as I said in the blog, when I first was reading about this, I couldn't understand why they were picking on a fat bloke. And it's also politically correct. Surely we'd have to call them obese now rather than fat. But then obviously...
Really? You can't call people fat now?
I'm not. Certainly not to their faces. I know.
Well, I don't think that's a good idea to call people fat to their faces. But I'm surely a fat person knows they're fat too. It shouldn't really be a derogatory term. Like, it's like some people like being afraid to point out that I'm brown. It's like, dude, I know I am. I have a mirror. I've been this way all my life. Trust me, I'm used to it. It's you who needs to get used to it. But. I'm pretty sure fat people are aware they're fat.
Okay, anyway, back to the fat man.
Okay.
So the fat man story, or the use of the fat man in the trolley problem, is that similar situation, but now you're not standing at a switch. Now you're standing on a bridge. The trolley is still going to hit the five people and kill the five people, but standing beside you on the bridge is a fat man. And you can push the fat guy over the bridge, and he will land on the tracks, and therefore... being killed, but also because he's fat, actually stopping the trolley from hitting the other five people. Okay, stop saying fat now. And then, and this is the classic variation for people. So when you do this in a philosophy class, you expect a certain amount of people will put their hand up for the first one, but you expect it to be less for this one.
Mm-hmm.
So do you, what would be your opinion as to why that would be? Or would you have a different perspective? For me, I see it as being a different thing, but... I'm not necessarily sure that would prevent me from pushing him anyway.
Oh, you know, this is a great part of the trolley car experiment, the thought experiment, bringing in the so-called fat man or extremely heavy person, because this time you actually have to get your hands dirty. You actually have to put your hands on somebody and be directly responsible for killing them. But on top of that, chances are you might have spoken to the heavy man. You might have interacted with him. You might have shared some human bond, and then you realize that these are no longer, you know, people, far away people, statistics on a train track somewhere far away. This is actually a human being just like you. And, you know, and I was telling, you know, what if, like, you know, you happen to be carrying something really heavy on your own back and they're actually thinking the same thing about you? It's like, you know, what if I push this really mouthy chick over the over the rail there? And you know, she talks too much, like, everyone would be happier, you know? So... suppose they wanted to do that, but yeah, there's a touch of humanity now. Now we have more emotionally invested in the man than we do the other six people, and also, like, you can't claim innocence if if you ever have to be brought up in front of a jury, they're still not going to see you as a very nice, innocent bystander if they know that you're just willing to psychopathically just dispose of a person that way, despite the fact that you're trying to save other people. Now, if it were me, I'd probably look at the heavy person and be like, "Oh my God, you have a louder voice than me." Or no. And I'll say, "See if you can shout and tell those people to move." I'll probably look at the person and be like, "Oh my God, this trolley is about to kill people. This is your problem now. I'm out of here." And just leave him to deal with the situation.
You raised a couple of really interesting things there, because firstly, you spoke about maybe you've interacted with this person, so you're investing a kind of a humanity to it on a level of connection, saying that, well, if I'm standing beside them, then the chances are I'll have spoken to them, because I'm not just going to be standing beside some random guy on a bridge and we're the only two people there without speaking to him. So you're moving away from it being a decision of an intentional action versus an unintentional action, to actually saying, well, it's not really down to that, it's because I've met this guy now and I don't want to push him over the bridge. But you also raised the topic of what if you were in a court of law, which is almost like a complete switch, because you can actually see that really what you're thinking is, I'd have no problem pushing him over the bridge, but if I end up in the court of law, it's a shitty defense. So
yeah.
I would like to think, so you're actually thinking, is Canada a very litigious society? Because your first answer was you would sue. Now you're thinking about being possibly sued yourself. So it's kind of very litigious or something.
I'd say it's relatively litigious. I mean, it wouldn't be exactly the United States, but it's relatively litigious.
Right. So I think that's a really interesting way. It's an interesting way of looking at it, though. Of course, the whole idea of the trolley problem is looking at a thing which is it's been well known for centuries. It's called the doctrine of double effect. I mean,
yeah.
Philippa Foot wrote about it in 1967. And she actually spoke about a version of the problem. I think she was probably one of the first ones to make the trolley problem, the cool one that everybody was talking about. But she spoke about a version of the problem going back before that, which is, again, unfortunately, had a fat man involved. It was where there was five people in a cave. And I'm trying to remember this right now. A fat guy was blocking the exit. And the only way they could get out was by blowing him out of the exit with dynamite. And this is a good way of explaining what the doctrine of double effect is, because they were using the dynamite to clear the hole, okay? They weren't using the dynamite to kill him. So they weren't intentionally killing him. They were just using the dynamite to blow him out of the hole. And his killing would then have been incidental to what they were doing. And this then is the same as when you flip the switch, when you're standing there and you flip the switch between one or the other, because you're flipping the switch to save the five people, and it's an incidental consequence that the one guy is going to get killed. Whereas the pushing the guy off is you actually intentionally doing something. So your action is the one that kills the one, whereas in the other one, your action saves the five, but as a consequence, one dies. Did I explain that right?
That explains it right, too.
Okay.
And again, I can't help thinking about court of laws, because I'm still thinking that, you know, a really smart lawyer, tough prosecutor is going to be like, really, your best decision was to kill a very rotund man, you know?
I love this. We both spoke about how, well, you mainly said how it was okay to call people fat, but since then you've used every other politically correct type of word to describe this as a rather heavy.
Okay, Sean, I don't think any of the words I've used were politically correct. The words I used were pretentious. Okay, let's get it straight.
Sorry,
all right.
I rephrase that. So since then, you've used every pretentious synonym, I can't even pronounce the word.
That's
synonym.
Better.
Yeah,
that is
every
better.
Pretentious synonym that you could find to describe this man instead of fat. However, okay, it's interesting that you would say again about the...
Because in the problem, he doesn't have to be fat. He just has to be really big and heavy. So let's say he's actually just like a big testosterone-filled gym freak who's just a bunch of muscles, you know? Let's say he's a muscle man.
Okay, he's a muscle man.
Okay. Oh, you know, let's say it's a muscle woman.
A muscle person. Oh, how about that?
A muscle person, yeah. You know, it's all kinds of muscle people, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. Where was I? Yes. It's interesting that you should say that, because I actually, in preparing for this, which I did do some preparation, in preparing for this, I incidentally unintentionally saw on TV this week, a TV program where it was a problem like this was actually used as part of the plot construct. The program was called Bull. It's about a guy who works for a company who helps people win court cases by figuring out how to make sure the jury is on their side, or that they pick the right type of juror to be on their side. It's very good.
I love stuff like that.
People should go out and watch it. But in this particular one, there was a pilot, mm-hmm. and she had crashed the plane, mm-hmm. killing everybody on board. But she just happened to survive, and she had done something. The plane was in an unrecoverable position. Okay, so the plane. It was a thing called the wind shear effect. I'm not going to go into all of the entire plot, but just to briefly explain it, the plane was in an unrecoverable position, but she did something which was recorded on the black box as being out of the norm, and this is why they were trying to...
did she throw a muscle person out the window and then the plane got lighter and then she saved everybody?
No.
I didn't see the episode, sorry.
No. Nothing as funny. Spoiler nothing as funny
alert.
As that,
but,
no, nothing as funny as that. But what she actually did, which they only found out at the end, because obviously it's a TV program and they have to keep it guessing until minute 55, was that she actually kept the plane up in the air for an extra 5 seconds and thereby saved hundreds of people in a small village or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's what she actually done. So even though she kind of unintentionally did it and then couldn't remember why she did it, throughout the entire episode, she had actually done the same thing. She knew she was sacrificing the people on the plane, but she knew they were going mm-hmm. to die anyway.
Yeah,
they were unsavable anyway.
Right.
Okay. Well, again, it's not. It was an unintentional killing. She could have crashed the plane, and they could have all miraculously escaped like her. But so she didn't intentionally kill them. But the chances were they were going to die, and she did an action that saved a load of people.
Mm-hmm.
So she went from being zero to hero. You know what I mean? So I think that's another kind of way of looking at it.
Yes.
Don't you think?
The fact that you might not know what the outcome is. I mean, in this case, she looks like the hero because she can always play she didn't know she was going to survive, so she was willing to sacrifice her life. And don't we love martyrs in our society? So
yes.
That brings in a martyrdom dimension to the trolley car problem, whereas I see the trolley car problem as a strictly selfish person problem. Maybe because I always make it selfish. I'm just like, Jesus, like, what am I going to tell the lawyers? What am I going to tell the judge? That's how I see it. Well, how much trouble am I going to get? Because I know I'm telling jokes, but there's a serious undertone to what I'm saying, is that in this society, especially the more uneducated elements of this society, sometimes we say things with very little thought as to what they mean, but our legal system doesn't work that way. I'm sure we can all agree that murder, killing is wrong, right? Or ignoring someone in need, that's wrong, you know? And people who kill or murder or ignore someone who's going to die, they should all go to jail, right? You know? Easy.
Yeah.
That's all. That's easy stuff. But when we look into this problem, we see that you know, sometimes in life anything can happen and we can find ourselves faced with someone else's life in our hands, and then all of a sudden our ideas of black and white and what's right or what's wrong and who deserves to die and who doesn't deserve to die get very, very blurry. You could still be held accountable in a court of law for not pulling any switch at all and watching everybody die. Maybe if you have the right lawyer, if you have a certain kind of judge, I don't know. We live in a litigious society where, you know, if you help someone who is choking or drowning, and let's say you end up breaking a rib or something on your course to saving them as an untrained layperson, you could still be sued and charged in a court of law for that action. Well, I know I'm from Canada, so I live really close to the States. I'm pretty sure this is an American problem.
Yeah.
I feel like the Irish are too practical to take that on seriously, but then again, I don't know.
I wouldn't rule it out, and I think even as a trained person, you could be sued for saving someone's life but breaking their ribs.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely 100% possible.
Sure, we were taught in life-saving, because when I was a teenager, I was being taught life-saving skills, how to be a lifeguard. And we were taught that, you know, the most important thing when you're trying to save a person from choking or trying to resuscitate them from drowning is getting their life back. So a few broken ribs is not a big deal in the grand scheme of things.
Of course, what we're talking about here is consequentialism.
Yeah.
I hate that word, consequentialism.
It's okay. Statistically speaking. Oh, I said statistically. Yeah. I can't believe it. I was gonna make you feel better by sharing the fact that I have a problem saying statistically. But
I wouldn't mind, but if I just leapt in and said the word, I was fine. But I didn't. I approached it from a great distance, very, very slowly, as if I was sneaking up on some kind of rabid animal. And I still messed it up.
Ah, you freaked yourself out.
I know, that's what it is. But it's with consequentialism, it's that the consequences are all that matter. In which case they would say that in all cases,
mm-hmm.
it's right to kill the one to save the five. Okay? That's essentially what consequentialism would say.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's interesting then, because and if you remember back to what I put in the blog,
yeah.
the last variation that I put in there was the one about the surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my favorite one, and the reason I wrote them in a specific sequence as well, because I put the airplane one first, because I think most people would look at the airplane one and say, if I was flying an airplane was going to crash anyway, and I had a choice between crashing it into a less dense or a more dense area, I'd go for the less dense area. I think people would accept that, and they wouldn't even, okay, they might think twice, and they may be a little concerned if they make it through themselves whether or not they're going to be sued, but I think that's an easier decision. Then you do the classic trolley switch, then you have the larger person, and then you have the surgeon one. And the surgeon one, for people who may not have read the blog, is that in the surgeon one, you have a surgeon has five people who need organ transplants. The five people are going to die. He can't find any organ donors. They're all on, all right up at the level where he needs the donor organs really quickly. And he suddenly, a guy comes in with a grazed knee or something minor wrong with him. He's a backpacker. He has no, during the course of the conversation, he reveals he has no family, no ties, no nothing. He's just literally drifting through. And funnily enough, this guy happens to be a perfect match to these other five people who have the same blood group, so he will be able to provide donor organs for them. And the question is, because it's again, you can sacrifice the one to save the five, should the surgeon kill this guy, knowing that he will never, that's the other thing with the surgeon one, and it takes litigation straight away out of it.
Yeah.
Okay? Knowing that he won't be found out as a murderer, should he kill this one guy to save the five?
Well, see, there's a condition that he's not going to be found out as a murderer, but the thing is, the surgeon has taken a Hippocratic oath and he simply cannot do that. This would be a choice on his part. And if he was being investigated by a governing board of surgeons, and they actually investigated using professionals and his peers to see if he was using best practices with this backpacker, he could still face some serious charges and possibly go to jail. But then again, surgeons try to make this decision. Certain medical professionals do have to face the hard decision when it comes to the issue of euthanasia. If they're dealing with patients that express a wish to terminate their lives early due to extreme illness or pain or whatever, I mean, there are people who still end up making this decision and face harsh penalties for it.
Yeah.
It just seems like the perfect crime, but then the surgeon is the one who has to live with it. In fact, you know, this backpacker just shows up and volunteers all this information about how they're a completely ghost person. And I'm thinking, like, that looks like a sting operation right there.
I know.
I read your blog. You called the doctor, Dr. House, and I know he's already in some deep shit already. All right. So.
Oh, yeah, I think in the last episode he faked his own death, so I think he's probably golden wherever he is. He rode off into the sunset on a motorbike with his baby mate.
And you know, in your problem, that's the continuation. That backpacker is actually Dr. House. He comes back as a backpacker, racks with guilt over the hard decisions he had to make. He feels like he needs to face justice, but no court of law will give him the justice that he needs. So he's like, you know what? I deserve to die. I'm going to orchestrate this plan and pass on my legacy to some poor other surgeon sap.
Well.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Sean, this is your fault for inviting creatives into your science podcast. You shouldn't bring us people on there because we're going to ruin your education outcomes.
Because all of the people that listen to this are doing it for educational outcomes.
Yeah.
Really, yeah. I don't. Yeah. Again, I think it's interesting that you just throw loads and loads. I'm waving my arms around here. Like people can see me on it. People can see me on an audio podcast. How stupid is
that?
But you throw loads and loads of other things into the mix, just so you don't have to make the decision. Because if you were going to follow consequentialism, then you'd say, well, then, you know, if he's never going to be found out, and there's no possibility.
I don't know. Well, we don't know what's going to happen. If I was the surgeon, what if I saw the backpacker? Now, I love to travel too. And let's say in this scenario, I'm also very single, or I'm widowed or divorced or something. And this backpacker is actually the most beautiful soul I ever met, and I fall in love with him. Well, then, like, those other people are fucked. Like, I'm running off with him. Off we go. Start a new life. So I don't know what's going to happen in that situation.
I definitely don't know either. I mean, between getting chatty with a large person on the bridge and
what if I fall in love with him too? What if he's a beautiful soul and I just, like, you know what? It's not fair. Fate has brought us together in the most awful way. Let's run away from each other. Only I know your deepest, darkest secret, which is that we couldn't help those five people on the track.
I can honestly say that in all of my thinking about these things, none of these things have ever occurred to me. So that clearly says that I'm a much different person, that I really have no kind of human empathy.
No, Sean, love crunkles. Love is a surprise. Love really throws a spanner into the works, you know. No one really thought about love when they were coming up with...
That sounds like the start of a country music song.
Yeah. I suppose the stand-up comedy thing doesn't work out. And for all those listening, so far love stand-up comedy has not been working out for me, so I think maybe I should move on to country song writing.
And now it's Rhonda Rana with her latest single, Love Really Throws a Spanner in the Works.
Yeah. That's a great name for a single. Sean, you and I should work together. You used to be in a band. We could do this.
Yeah, I'll do the music. You can do the lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely. And I'll do it under an assumed name as well. I'll take the money. I have no problem taking the money, but I don't want to be associated with country music.
Oh, that's so sweet that you think we're going to make money.
Oh. Of course. Oh. Everybody always make money.
Yeah. What were we talking about again? Oh, yeah, the surgeon. What do I have to decide? I don't know. You know what? Let's say I'm the surgeon and I've had like a really long day and I haven't had my cup of coffee for the week yet. And, you know, I just was like, you know, really, I need to win. I need to save some lives. You know what? Screw the backpacker. Just save everybody. Let's cover it up. Let's cover the whole incident up and I'll see if I can even wangle an award for myself after all this. After all, I'm in the business of saving people. So what? You know, they should be thanking me. You know, ungrateful society. Obtuse legal system. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm a goddamn hero, you know, that's what it is.
That's it, yeah. I mean, I've saved those five people. I mean, like, who cares about this guy? I willingly tell everybody what I did to save these five people, because not only did I have to kill him, he's a young, fit guy, kill him, keep all his organs viable, right, so I could do five operations on my own.
Yeah.
Because obviously I couldn't bring anybody else in, and I couldn't do it in the proper operating theatre, so I had to do it at home on the kitchen table under crappy lighting.
Yeah.
Lighting. So I saved those five people. Yeah. So you guys should be thanking me.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you know, screw love in this, because not only am I a surgeon, which means I already make a lot of money, but now I'm an acclaimed surgeon who saved all these people. Like, that's really, I have like all of the Hawkeyes to choose from now, you know. I don't have to worry about that one, the one that got away because I killed him, you know. Like,
no,
yeah,
exactly.
I have nothing to lose in this situation. All about me.
I would love to have this conversation with some of those people who have really strong views on stem cell research.
Oh, boy.
I think it would be so funny. Because they're just talking about cells and we're just openly talking about, well, let's just kill the guy.
Yeah.
he's a veritable smorgasbord of organs that we need, for God's sake.
And what a waster, too. What kind of life is backpacking? By the way, I've backpacked. He should get a real job. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try and drag this back a little bit to some of the topic. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. There was one other, I saw this depicted, or something similar to this depicted on TV during the week as well, on a program called Sherlock, which I know you're aware of.
I love Sherlock.
And unfortunately, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this are probably aware of it as well, starring the great Benedict Cumberbatch. And because you're
or as my husband
Canada.
Loves to call him, Engelbert Humperdinck.
Okay.
Yeah.
He does know there's a real person called Engelbert Humperdinck.
Yeah, we all know that. It's just the point is that he thinks Benedict Cumberbatch is a ridiculous name.
And,
I don't know.
Okay,
I know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
I went
yeah,
to high school in the ghetto. Like, there's no way you're going to name your kid Benedict Cumberbatch and expect to send them to school in the ghetto. They're going to get beat up. You only name your kids shit like that when you're trying to impress people with how rich you are, because you only have had to be an extremely rich person to go around with such a ridiculous name and still be alive because you have so much money.
Benedict, thanks for listening up to now. I'm sorry to lose you as a listener, but please feel free to spam Rhonda.
Oh my God, no, Benedict. I don't think he doesn't have an army. I like Benedict Cumberbatch, but I'm just saying, like, there are no kids from the ghetto who are named Benedict Cumberbatch. Okay,
if he happens to be listening to this podcast and spams you, that would be so cool.
That'd be awesome. Yeah. I'd love to prove him wrong about something like that.
Anyway, I don't want it because of people not in this part of the world who may not have seen, because this is the last episode of the most recently shown series. I don't want to give away any spoiler alert, but there was, again, a kind of a plot construct in it, which was basically a psychopath who was giving, I'll say it was Sherlock because I don't think that gives away too much, a choice between, you have three people here, if you don't pick which one to kill, I'll kill all three. It was actually used a number of different times within the one episode, which was really, really cool, seeing that I knew it was coming up to talking about this. But it's again something that's interesting, and that actually made me think as well about how maybe people who would use the trolley car effect as a kind of a way for justifying, you know, if you're purely going to talk about consequentialism and say, well, the means justifies the end. The end justifies the means. I always get those wrong. The end justifies the means. It doesn't matter how I get it. It's the consequences that are important. It justifies things like torture, like Guantanamo Bay and all that kind of stuff, and all the rendition program and things like that. That if there's a possibility that by waterboarding somebody for 24 hours and making him listen to Justin Bieber or whatever it is they do to them, that it's going to make him talk about a possible plot, then it's worthwhile doing. So I think there is a very big risk that if we do think about the trolley problem being anything more than a thought experiment, then, you know, that it does actually justify these kind of things.
It's more than a thought experiment. You know, I think it's in practice in the world. There are many large organizations, pharmaceutical companies, energy, gas, and oil companies that experiment or dump on poor parts of the world full of what the Western world would consider undesirables or just invisible people we don't even consider. And their excuse is, well, you know, these people are going to blow themselves up anyways, or they're just no good to society anyways, or no one's going to care about them. Oh, prisoners are another example, you know, testing things out on prisoners. Well, yeah, no one cares about them. So, you know, in fact, in order to help more good people, we just, you know, we have to break a few eggs. I mean, these decisions are made in this very day and age. It's never really about the amount of people. It's about the quality of people. I mean, the fact of the matter is we don't see all lives as equal. We don't see all lives as having equal worth. You know, let's say there's a plot to kill the president. Well, not President Trump, but say there's a plot
random
to kill
president.
We
don't want to see CIA. We don't want the CIA getting involved. A random, random president.
But let's say, in a fictional world, let's say there was, well, not totally fictional, a parallel, whatever. Okay, there's a plot to kill the president. In this world, it's a very good president. We all like this president. He's a very important person. You know, in that case, that president's life has more weight than the people who are protecting him, such as the army and the personal bodyguards. We are willing to break those. The people have agreed, you know, they would put the president's life before theirs. So in a way, they know what they're getting into. But yes, then we're going into martyrdom and sacrifice. But I think there is something in our psyches that do believe that certain people's lives have more weight than other people's lives. And in that case, we look to preserve the more valuable life rather than the quantity of life. I mean, a spanner is thrown in the works of the trolley car problem if we start designating values to the people on the track. Let's say the very heavy man, is very rich or very influential or very important, you know, maybe we wouldn't be so hasty to kill them. The single person on the track is not just anyone, that's your mom, you know. or yeah, your wife exactly. or somebody like that, you know, maybe you wouldn't really be thinking about quantity of life. You'd be thinking about value. Let's say that the five people on the tracks, they're, you know, they're a bus full of school children who just happen to be on the tracks. You know, these things matter.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I was thinking about in terms of industry and stuff like that, where industry might have to use, let's not say the trolley car problem, but might have to use similar type of algorithm, would be self-drive cars.
I think what you're getting onto is correct. Like, we still have to apply this problem when it comes to smart technology. We now have to program ethics into machines, such as self-driving cars or self-flying airplanes.
Exactly. That's kind of what I wanted to get to. I mean, like, then we have to be very careful, and who is correct and who can be trusted to program the ethics mm-hmm. into the computers. Like, I love the way people talk sometimes about robots. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of Asimov's laws, isn't it? About robots.
Yes.
That a robot can't. I wish I can remember them properly.
Oh my gosh!
But that a robot can never harm its master or something like that.
Mm.
Who says? I mean, Asimov didn't create all the robots that are ever likely to be created.
Yeah.
A robot could quite easily just kind of go, ha, and pick up literally a spanner and stick it through the back of your head.
And let's not forget, in Asimov's time too, I don't know if he could foretell that. Now he was a visionary, I have to say. This is what I love about sci-fi. It's always leagues and steps ahead, centuries even. I think all good science fiction writers were visionaries and did have a sense of the future, and that's my final thought on that. But I don't know if in Asimov's time he would have realized how smart we'd be able to create artificial intelligence. Now we're teaching computers how to learn. I mean, even Siri or my autocorrect on my phone is learning the way that I write and the things that I write and how I talk to predict my next sentence. So we're inventing learning technology. Why can't a computer learn ethics, especially if we begin to program ethics into them? First, we'll program the ethics such that, okay, we want to save the greatest amount of lives. But what if we apply other technologies? What if, the computer can see the credit scores of everybody they're about to kill and be like, oh, these people all have really bad credit. Yeah, let's kill them, you know?
Exactly. So the computer starts to form its own type of
ethics,
it almost starts to practice its own type of eugenics, as in making a decision as to whether or not people's lives are worthwhile, and if they're not worthwhile, then we don't need them in society. They're just taking up valuable food, space, and air, so let's get rid of them. So
that is fascinating. I mean, you're saying, it does extend to eugenics in a certain way. I think that this problem can apply to something as serious as eugenics, especially in the age of technology. The trolley car sounds so outdated, but it does have its very real world applications in modern technology.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that would be the concern. Everybody knows that apart from the computers that can actually learn very well, I mean, most computers are only as clever as the programmer who's programmed them, you know what I mean? So I would be concerned that, you know, that how can you program the ethics into any type of technology, you know, so that it will make the right decision at the right time.
And if we want to go back to philosophy, let's not forget that ethics is still the biggest philosophical subject of all philosophers. All philosophers worth their salt have tackled ethics. It's because ethics is so ambiguous. We're trying to, we're still kind of determining whether ethics comes down to a very human need or necessity and what that necessity is, to whether it's actually something imbued on us from the divine. But ultimately, ethics, while we consider them as ideals by which to live by, could very much just be a set of arbitrary rules that we give ourselves and that are as fundamentally flawed as the human being, itself. So what was the point I was trying to make? But, you know, ethics in and of themselves are not reliable.
No, of course not. I mean, and ethical thinking that is based on any of the major religions is not reliable, because, I mean, I think in any of those type of conversations, what you have to do, irrespective of your belief system, is position yourself as if you have no belief system, because you can't depend on any belief system, because the history of of most of the belief systems is that they've gone through a lot of evolution and changes to cope with changes that happened in the world around them. I mean, you know, Christianity is probably the best example of that. I mean, they had a certain amount of beliefs before the Enlightenment, and then once the Enlightenment happened and people started to be able to read and books were being brought around, then their beliefs changed kind of different, and then they kept changing, and it's not really a coincidence that Vatican II in Catholicism happened just about after the time where television became widespread and people's ability to acquire knowledge moved up another logarithmic step. So it wasn't a gradual change. It went from getting a certain amount of information to instantaneously having every type of information available. So, I mean, a lot of those belief systems, and certainly the one that I would know the best, having been brought up, you know, as a Christian and as a Catholic, is that they have moved in these big jumps to correspond to what is happening in the world around them, you know?
Yeah.
Wow, getting really heavy.
I know. We have to be careful because, you know, we don't want to step into some sticky territory, because that's not what we're doing here. But yes, the nature of ethics is sticky, because we cannot define what a standard code of ethics is. And sure, even Philippa Foote herself even challenged ethics. She was challenging Kant's consequentialism, saying that, you know, he's kind of a self-righteous prat. You know, this idea that everyone must live so ethically and morally right and be so self-righteous would make for an insufferable, boorish, and also brutal world. And also, for some reason, humans don't really like particularly perfectly ethical people. I mean, just look at the celebrities we idolize. We all love the bad boys and the bad girls out there. You know, just think about, we love our mavericks. We love our lawbreakers. In fact, there's something about somebody who has a bit of a dark past that's more genuine and attractive, because it's like they've really lived life and have learned lessons firsthand.
Yeah.
And maybe even have more compassion because of those things. They've become more in touch with the fallibility of their humanity.
And also the fact that I think we don't believe, if somebody doesn't have some skeletons in their closet or a past, we don't believe it.
Yeah.
We don't believe it's true.
Yeah.
You couldn't possibly. No, definitely. There's something. You're hiding something.
Mm-hmm.
But interesting that you brought up Kant again.
Yeah.
Okay. Because Kant believed that we would always choose the 1/5 in all cases.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he believed that we did it because that as a human, and he used it as one of the ways of saying that how humans differ from animals, including primates, and that we would do it because of reasoning. So it's our ability to reason that would always mean that we would look at and weigh up the 1 versus the 5 and decide that it's better to save the 5. Okay?
Yeah.
So have you read the research done by Green, whose first name eludes me at the moment, in Princeton? Princeton University? No? Please say no. I don't want to blow your mind.
I haven't, Sean Marshall, the comedian and also host of this podcast. Please go on.
Prepare for your mind to be blown.
Okay, I will.
Because Jonathan Green, that's it. Mm. Because this actually shows once and for all why or how we should just choose the unintentional harming versus the intentional harming. In other words, if it's the switch or the airplane, yes, but if it's pushing a guy or anything else where we have to actually interfere and actually as a direct result of our action, someone is going to lose their life, and it's an intentional part of our action that we wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
In his research, he found that when you asked people this problem, okay, and you got them to seriously make a decision, okay? So, it's serious research here. So you get people, you're asking people who are not aware of the problem, and you're telling them the problem, and you're getting them to seriously make a decision. When it was done with the switch problem, and he measured what parts of their brain light up. I love this idea. I would love, I don't necessarily want to go and have an MRI scan, but I love the idea of somebody being able to plug your brain into something and see what parts light up when you do different things. I'd like to see what part of your brain lights up when you get tickled.
Oh, yes, of course.
I just, because that's just how
I believe Steven Pinker did a similar experiment, or he was referencing Green's work. I mean, sorry, I have not heard of this.
Excuse me.
My bad. Sorry.
All right. I'll see you're Green and raise you somebody else. Okay, way to put me back in my place.
It's okay, you can edit that part out. Why not pull up a girl voice and be like, please go on, Mr. Science Man, sir?
It's okay. I actually was just so proud that I actually found real research that was actually done by a real scientist in a real university when I was looking this up, because it's so long since I kind of researched anything. But anyway, basically, right, when you throw the switch, you found that it was the reasoning part of the brain that lit up.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But for all the other bits, it was the feeling and emotional part of the brain that actually lit up.
Mm-hmm.
So irrespective of what Kant believed and his consequentialism, the only part where it was actually driven by reasoning is when it's an unintentional one versus the intentional one. And to me, that means, even though I would have maybe started off looking at this topic as the type of person who would have said, well, it's always going to be, I'll pick the one over the five, irrespective of what the circumstances are, because it's the end result that is important.
Well, this is probably why Philippa Foot thought he was such a bore, because he was thinking that humans act only on reason. Now, it could have been a product. He could have been a product of his time, where at the time maybe reasoning survived all. But I will tell you this, as someone who has a great interest in this field, marketers have known this for years, that if you try to sell your products to people based on reason alone, you're not going to dominate the market. All advertising, all effective advertising, directly targets the emotional center. In fact, humans don't always rely on logic to solve their problems. Emotion plays a huge part, and then we act on our emotions and we try to rationalize it out later, saving our ass in that court of law that I keep bringing us back to. That's why we need logic. We just hire a really good lawyer. It's like, okay, man, here's lots of money and you're logical. Get me out of this. I killed this five people because the backpacker was really hot, okay? He was just so hot. I'm so sorry. I'm in love.
Okay. I think we've exhausted this topic. I don't think there's anything left in it. Do you?
I don't know. I could talk with you all day. Although it was much more fun when we used to talk in pubs and stuff like that. Any listeners out there, if you ever get a moment with Sean Marshall, seriously, a very funny, very interesting, well-educated man, great for a good chat.
and exactly the same about Rhonda, except for the bit because she's not a man. Obviously, she's a lady.
Yeah.
But other than that, exactly the same. No, I mean, yeah, I could talk about it for another few hours, but there's probably a limit to how long people are going to listen to it being on a podcast. So I think for now we might just draw the podcast to a close.
Sure. I hope there's some energy. Let's draw it to a close. And I'm sure if anyone wants to, contact us to discuss the problem more, you know, we can give you our Twitter handles or our social media.
Give us your Twitter handle there.
My Twitter handle, I post, contact me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Rhonda, that's R-H-O-N-D-A, _ Rana, that's R-A-N-A. And you can reach me on Twitter there. And, you know, we can talk more about consequentialism, marketing, emotions, et cetera. Or you can just tell me how cool I look in my pictures. That's awesome, too.
Please do contact me. I can't promise to talk about consequentialism, but if you want to talk about fat guys, I can do that all day long. So that's it for now. I've been Sean Marshall, and you've been
Rhonda Rana.
And thank you very much for listening.